Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is Dick Staub, your host. Thanks for joining us tonight at Kindling's Hales Brew. What is it called? The Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, just rolls right off the tongue. And we're going to have a very interesting show tonight. It is a holiday, and so glad to see all of you folks out here, even though you had the day off, theoretically. And tonight we're going to be discussing Glee, a surprising hit on Fox TV. It's been amazingly successful. It is the season's number one entertainment series among teens, top three series among adults 18 to 49 and 18 to 34. It has a loyal fan base called Gleeks. Do we have any Gleeks here tonight? Woohoo! Yeah, there they are. It has two platinum, two gold albums, two Grammy Award nominations, more than 16 million song downloads. It's a record for the most titles on Billboard Hot 100 by a non-solo act. It beat out the Beatles. The number one soundtrack of 2010, the Christmas album. 19 Emmy, 2010. It received 11 Golden Globe nominations. It's the most nominated series of the year. It's got four Emmy Awards. Last night at the Golden Globe, it won three of the top prizes, including award for Best TV Show, Musical or Comedy. Actor Chris Colfer, who plays Kurt Hammer, was named Best Supporting Actor. Co-star Jane Lynch won for Best Supporting Actors, Actress for her portrayal of sadistic school coach Sue Sylvester. Isn't this exciting? I just can't. Whoa. Thanks, Carlo. So anyway, we're going to be talking about Glee tonight, and we've already taken a little poll, and it appears that a good number of people in this fine audience have stooped so low as to watch the show, and there's a number of them that aren't willing to admit it, but that are closet Glee fans, closet Gleeks.
Gleeks.
Is what they would be. And tonight, to discuss this show, we've got Dr. Jeff Cuse, who I don't know if you know is an SPU-tenured professor, and an engaging interpreter of theology and popular culture. We've got Jenny Spohr, who's host, producer of the Kindling's Muse, film critic, ordained Presbyterian clergy. And we've got Heather Hawkins, who is a Seattle actor, co-director of spring musicals at Eckstein Middle School and Olympic View Elementary School. Let's have a big round of applause for all of our guests.
Thank you.
And Heather was on the first ever Kindling's Muse right here. At Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. The show was called Irreligious Seattle and the Spiritual Book Craze. If Seattle is so irreligious, why are they reading all these spiritual books?
And so you got to shorter titles now, I see.
Yeah. Well, obviously, my ability to pronounce even short titles has diminished considerably over the years. We had it set up completely different. The stage was back there. We were started 20 minutes late because for some reason we couldn't get the sound system to work, and it turned out that one of you audience members had backed up a chair and unplugged the speakers. And so we had all these elite professional technical people that were here to avoid anything going wrong, scurrying around, working with all this stuff, and there was just this hapless little cord unplugged right next to a speaker. So it was a great night, and Heather got us off to a great start that night, and she's going to get us started tonight. Because not everyone here is familiar with this show, the storyline, the characters. And Heather's going to give us an overview of this show through the pilot episode. So what did we learn from the pilot about what this show was going to be about, who some of the characters were going to be, what the storyline was going to unfold as?
You know, I rewatched the pilot, the director's cut,
with
my kids this weekend. And
there are PhDs being offered in Gleek now, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
You're here.
Yeah. And I mean, for just on a really personal level, the first time that I saw the show, I felt like someone was, you know, preaching to me about my life and my childhood and my high school years. And then as a teacher, what I, you know, do every day with kids. But what I feel like Ryan Murphy really set out to do in that pilot is, you know, he sort of talks about it, I think, in the opening scene. Will Schuster is a Spanish teacher at a school, at a small suburban school in Ohio. The former Glee teacher leaves, gets sort of told on, gets caught in a slightly awkward sexual harassment moment, leaves the building. And Will Schuster is standing there realizing there's no one to teach the Glee Club, and he's standing in front of a trophy case, and he sees himself and his old choir teacher from when they won the national competition in 1993, and there's a quote in the trophy case under her picture, and it says, "By its very definition, Glee is about opening yourself up to joy." And from there, the episode sets out, I think, what Ryan Murphy wants to do. He sort of introduces us to the typical cast of characters in a high school, who fits in, who doesn't fit in, and these kids that are dying to sing. And he has auditions for them. We get introduced to Sue Sylvester, as you called her, the slightly sadistic. See, I can't even talk tonight. The slightly sadistic, or maybe very sadistic, gym teacher, head of the Cheerios, and throughout that episode, I feel like he also sets up really the idea of musical theater. You know, a lot of times we talk about Glee as just this, you know, this great show, and yes, it might touch on, it has music in it, but he really follows this whole tradition of American musical theater in that. Musicals often, you know, happen, people start singing them because they can't, they're so upset, or they're so excited, or they're so sad that they have to express themselves in a song. And often musicals start with something that we call the I wish song. You know, I wish for something to happen. At the beginning of Into the Woods, all the characters sing, I wish. You know, I wish this would happen. And in at the end of that very first episode, they all sing Don't Stop Believin', which becomes their I wish song for the Glee Club to succeed, for it to happen, for them to, you know, make their way. I was saying to Jenny earlier that I feel like the best moments on Glee are when they really, those songs punctuate an emotional undercurrent, something that's happening with the characters. And I really feel like that's what happens in that first episode in Don't Stop Believin'.
So did the producer have this in his own background? You know, do they come out of this as part of their own journey, do you know?
Help me out. I'm not sure that, I mean...
Ryan Murphy, who, and by the way, we're mentioning Ryan Murphy. He's the showrunner for the show. He previously did a show on, I think it was a Fox, Nip and Tuck. It was a show on Fox. Had a lot of success, built a lot of capital because he made that show successful. And therefore, when you get to make a successful show, you get to do whatever you want, right? And so Ryan Murphy had this dream, basically, based on the success of what he saw in the Disney franchise with High School Musical and others, to really create another kind of singing show. And to be rather economic about it, he created a business model that was very compelling. And what would it mean to create a show where we do covers of songs that already exist, right? Therefore, you already have an audience of people who want these songs, right? You propel these songs forward. You do them in a new arrangement. So therefore, if it's a new arrangement, we get to claim part of the copyright of the song, so it doesn't go just to the artist. Steve Perry made a lot of money and is living quite happily right now because of the Journey songs that are happening here. but because they're made very new, he created this way of doing this. And so the idea that he launched to Fox was, we'll create a show, we'll have a certain number of set pieces, songs that are performed, audience, you know, will see this, they can instantly download the song as they're watching the song, and literally you can watch the tally every night go up on iTunes as each song is performed. So this is very compelling to network executives, and they loved it. And it turned out to be more than they ever dreamed, of being very successful. Now, part of it is he saw a potential in creating a link between the visual and the musical. And so that's part of what he always dreamed of.
But, you know, we talk about zeitgeist, the spirit of the age.
Right.
I thought musicals ended when I was in musicals, like in the, you know, the dark ages.
Right.
I mean, nobody was talking about High School Musicals. The Disney thing comes along, and then this comes along, and it's like, oh, is this still going on? What was it about today's age that made this fit, other than the commercial possibility of selling a lot of stuff on iTunes?
Well, I think part, I mean, and again, we can get into the business model, but I want to talk about the show as well. But I mean, part of what happened is that we started going home as opposed to the movies. So, you know, the part of the launch was, there's been a lot of attempts from the late 90s into the aughts, you know, the age we're in now as we finished out the last decade, of trying to get big musical, you know, films out there. They're very expensive to do, but they didn't really take. What happened is that on television, this is what they found with the High School Musical franchise, and being behind something like that was to create a show that in people's homes they could do that in a new way. So the intimacy of the television experience in a home theater somehow connected. And also the mass media direct connection with being able to do digital downloading. It's one of the biggest things that you'll see with this show is music being an instant connection point. You don't have to wait for the album to come out for 2 weeks. It's right there. I mean, actually, they launch all of the songs 1 week prior to the episode that's coming out. So there's a lot of expectation. People listen to the music before they even get to the show. They've already listened to it, downloaded it, and then they watch the show as it's being performed.
But the concept of a musical. Well, I mean, why was that? Why did that hit?
Well, musicals haven't gone away.
Really?
Sound of Music was not the last musical. And you start looking at musicals that have impacted people's lives, you know, through the 70s and the 80s. You've got Footloose, you've got Grease, you've got, you know, all these musicals throughout each generation or each decade that have been in the pop culture that have talked to people where they're at. And this is just a new iteration for this generation.
But I do think, I mean, you were asking that question of why, you know, did musicals disappear, right? Did they stop getting done? Well, they still are being done. I mean, Seattle has one of the top ranked musical theater high school programs in the country at Roosevelt High School. You know, with tons and tons of kids, and not like your stereotypical drama kids, but like kids that, you know, play sports and do music and do theater. I don't think, you know, the kids I teach, they feel like the show to them is a validation of what they do, and it's exposing more kids to wanting to do it too. So I feel like I feel like it never went away. Maybe it wasn't as popular for a while, but I feel like now, because of the show, all more kids are getting excited, wanting to do musicals again, wanting to be in show choir again.
How does American Idol connect to all this?
Well, it's interesting because they're both Fox properties. And so, I mean, again, I feel like I'm the business person at this table.
Which is odd.
I'm supposed to be the theologian at the table. But one of the things you're seeing now is that, I mean, it'll be interesting to see that this season of American Idol as it launches, you know. But American Idol as a brand has been declining. And so Fox was looking for something similar to that business model, you know, that launched music, connected it to the media, and it's interesting. Glee has kind of picked up and started to ascend, where American Idol has started to go down.
And I also think American Idol is about fame in a lot of ways, right. and it's also just about, I mean, not just, that's terrible, but being a singer. And I think that Glee has dramatic structure behind it.
Right.
It's not reality television. It has, says the actor, you know, wanting job and, you know, work for her friends. but it's a story, right, that's being written. It follows narrative structure. It follows, you know, journeys of students and their emotional journey. I think that there's more payback in something like Glee, where those songs have an emotional wallop, you know?
Okay.
I mean, musical theater is all about emotional whiplash, right? Like, we're like, we sing a song and we have this feeling, and then the next second someone else falls in love with someone else. I mean, that's why I love musical theater.
So let me start naming some of the characters and tell me why they're important to this series.
Okay.
Well, first of all, we got Will Schuster.
I'm wearing my Will Schuster sweater tonight, by the way. So I wanted to have a prop. So this is my Mr. Schuster.
He's a fashion model in residence.
Yeah, yeah.
As a theologian,
that's right.
Does it all.
I did, yeah. That's right, yeah. So Will Schuster is, as Heather mentioned, is what we call the in locus parentis, or in place of the parent, right? So he becomes the organizing principle around which, and he, in a sense, which kind of strangely, is supposed to be the adult for these kids. And as in the first season, his marriage falls apart. He goes through a divorce. Wife faces a pregnancy. She tries to basically get a baby from one of the Glee kids who's pregnant.
Yeah, this happens every day.
Yeah, this is pretty much the story of any church. So you have these kind of movements that start happening in this show, and what Will Schuster is trying to do in a very interesting way is he's trying to, on one hand, say that this was the most important thing in my life, right? I mean, American pop culture works on a two-decade principle, right? So we have, for example, you have Happy Days coming out to reflect on the 50s, but it came out in the 70s, right? It took two decades for people to have enough they age through, they remember their adolescence, they become people, then they reflect back on it because they want to recapture it. Glee is a similar type of thing. It's recapturing this late 70s, early 80s music, but it's, and we're going to talk about this later, but the mashup with current music is a way to kind of bridge it into the current generation. And Will Schuster is that bridge generation. He's on one hand trying to talk to the kids where they are and bridge them into what their futures are going to be. And he's the big dreamer, right? You know, if we can just make this happen, your lives will be great. You'll kind of realize all your dreams. So that's, and that's who Will is in the show.
Now, I want to get back to this parent thing.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's very important, but let's move on. Sue Sylvester, why is she important? Jenny?
Jane Lynch in anything is amazing.
Oh, gosh, I love her. Yeah. Well, she, you've got to have an arch nemesis. I mean, you have to have someone in the show who's, you know, Dr. Evil and trying to drag you down. And so Sue is that, is Will's foil. And she's basically, she gets all the great one-liners, I mean, in the whole show. So she's just a dream for the writers, I'm sure. And we, you know, you just laugh through it. But she has some touching moments as well.
Now, yeah, this is one of the interesting things. This show, she has a Down syndrome sister.
That's what I was going to mention.
So on the one hand, she's this total insensitive creep. But then on the other hand, they bring a little texture to her. There's a little more than that.
There's more to her. In fact, one of the episodes we're going to talk about tonight, Grilled Cheeses, there's a very touching there's a very touching moment.
It's
with
a cheesy episode. Yeah.
None of us thought our careers were going to end up here. Let me tell you that, folks. Talking about Grilled Cheeses.
But where she has a very touching moment with her sister talking about God. And so she is definitely a multidimensional character, but she's kicking
Rachel.
Her pants.
Rachel. Amazing talent. I mean, at the age of 8, she made her Broadway debut as Young Cassette in Les Mis.
Yeah, this is Lea Michele.
There's
Lea
a
Michele.
Lot of really, really talented people on the show. So what is her kind of placeholder in Glee?
So Rachel in Glee is your typical, she is the perfect singer, the perfect dancer. She dreams of being on Broadway and having her own album. She makes MySpace videos every week, updating them of herself singing to make sure that she has people following her career. However, not everyone thinks that she's so famous because in her school she often gets slushied or slurpied or
slushied. The branding of 7-Eleven hasn't happened.
Okay,
thank you.
So she might not be the most popular person at school, but she is the most talented. She is a mini diva.
She actually knows how talented she is.
Yeah, she
and
does.
That's her downfall.
Her fatal.
Okay.
Yeah. So
now how about Finn, football player?
Finn was discovered by Mr. Schuster singing
naked in the shower.
But
it's true.
He heard him singing and thought, okay, now I have a male singer to sing opposite Rachel. He recruited him in a very not so smart way by getting him in trouble and saying that you had to join Glee Club.
He planted drugs on him.
Jeff's really telling it like it is. I'm like sort of smoothing it over.
Yeah, here you have a school teacher who plants a joint on a high school student.
So he can get him.
And says, look, if you don't join Glee Club, I will tell everybody this is yours.
This is yours.
But for his own good.
Yes.
Okay.
So he can discover himself. He's also the captain of the football team.
Oh,
and
yes,
the quarterback. So you got it—the ultimate jock.
Now, how does the jock?
Guy,
how does the jock? Huge kind of Glee Club thing play itself out in this show?
Well, I was going to say one of the things that this does, and actually Finn is an example of this, is one of the things the show is trying to do is that nobody can be categorized fully in one or the other. Part of what the journey of the, I keep saying journey because the band is making a lot of money on the show, but the journey of all these characters as well as the show is to show that you can't say, well, the Glee Club is this, because it's more complex than that. And as we get into the other characters, you're just a jock. Well, you can only be a jock, right? No, you can be jock and a singer.
But they still play that out.
They do.
The exception.
And part of the key part of adolescent development is understanding, am I this or am I that? And part of the journey, particularly in high school, as we look at adolescent development theory, is how do I situate the complexities of life into an identity? Do I have to choose this or this, right? And if it's both, and that becomes very complex. And so that's what the show is trying to show. Is that you have Finn both as a jock and a Glee person. And in the second season, it becomes even more punched up because he basically is told that he has to choose one or the other. And he can't have both.
And he can't be cool and be, you know, he's got to choose one of the cool. It's almost like if you go on IMDb and you see the star meter. I don't know if you've ever seen that. If you look up a person, their star meter is either rising or falling. It's sort of the same with the Glee Club. Like, he's popular for a week, but then, you know, Puck was popular, then he shaved his mohawk, and now he's being thrown in a dumpster. I mean, there's not... Puck's the other jock on
Glee
Club.
Okay, now, who wants to talk about Kurt? Who, it's interesting to me, I went to the website to see how they describe Kurt,
yes.
And this is what they said. The baby-faced soprano with a fierce eye for fashion.
Which is interesting that none of that is about the fact that he's gay.
Right. You know, they don't say at the website that he's gay.
Yeah, one of the things
that just a fierce eye for fashion, like somebody chose special outfit.
Yeah, there you go. I wore it. Yeah. So Kurt's one of the probably the most compelling characters and really one of the breakout stars of the show. Yeah.
And the story won the Golden Globe.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing that I love too about this character is that Ryan Murphy, the writer and creator of the show, hadn't even written his character.
That's right.
And he got called in for an audition, and they fell in love with Chris Colfer in this audition.
He had auditioned for Artie.
Yeah,
the boy who's in the wheelchair is what Chris Colfer auditioned for. But they didn't cast him for that. But they created this
character of Kurt. Hummel.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, if that character didn't exist, what a different show it would be.
Right. And part of what you have, and again, we'll go into this a little bit, but I mean, part of what you get in Kurt is, again, the complexities of identity, right, which is what the show is really about, is where do you identify yourself? So here you have a gay character, very flamboyantly so, in a school that he's getting tortured for, and actually the second season has to do with abuse issues. He has to leave
and
his school.
Yeah,
because of it. But at the very heart of who he is this deeply compassionate person. His best friend on the show is another character, Mercedes, who's also ostracized for other reasons, and they both see themselves on the margins. But what's interesting is it quickly becomes apparent that they're actually not on the margins at all, actually in their center of a lot of things. So Kurt is actually, I mean, what's interesting about how his character has broken out on the show has been a voice for, in many ways, a lot of teen America. And he's become one of the most identified figures in teen America for a number of reasons.
Now we have Artie Abrams in a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
This is the Glee Club singing, dancing, and there's a kid in a wheelchair. What's that about?
Well, part of it you take a snapshot of this Glee Club. It's the total, you know, PC. Everybody, you've got a black kid, an Asian kid, a kid in a wheelchair, a gay kid. I mean, you've got everybody.
Jewish girl who
can sing. Yes. So, I think that's kind of part of it, of why he's there. But Artie also is having an interesting character arc as well, that he is starting to believe in himself and not be discouraged by the fact that he can't walk. And he's starting to come to the realization that it's okay that he's in this wheelchair. Of course, the very last episode that we saw, he's in this like electronic walker thing.
Right.
That'll be an interesting thing to see, you know,
if they use that more. Yeah.
One of my favorite Artie moments though is when he covers Dancing with Myself and he's sitting
Safety dance.
Yeah, and he's sitting in his wheelchair and he's, you know, playing it with the guitar.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to be back momentarily to continue our conversation about Glee with Jeff Kuse, Jenny Spohr, and Heather Hawkins. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to Killings Muse at Hale's Ales Brewing Pub. We'll be right back. Dick Staub back with you. You're listening to Kindling's Muse at Hale's Ales Brewery and Pub, where we're talking about Glee. And man, who knew there was going to be so much to talk about? Who knew there was that much to this show? But there is a lot. There's a lot of layers.
I did.
Yes.
A lot.
Jeff did, and he's got the sweater to prove it. Our guy, the baby-faced soprano with a fierce eye for fashion, Jeff Kuse, is with us tonight. And there's a couple other characters that we have not yet talked about. One of them is Mercedes, and you say she is central to this show.
Oh, absolutely. Mercedes is an African-American woman who is also very heavy on the show, so she doesn't fit into, again, what people would think is the ideal beauty. She comes into the show in a sense kind of a counterpoint to Rachel, where Rachel is a diva who comes in and Mercedes says, "Oh, no, you're not." And so they create foils for each other in a really interesting way. The thing about Mercedes that's really interesting in the first season, she really is kind of brash. She comes in as basically saying, I've got the pipes, you know, I can sing. But what you get in the second season is a sensitive core, and she is actually the faith core of the show in many ways. Particularly in the grilled cheeses episode that we'll talk about. She, yes, there is a show called that. She is the one who takes Glee to church in a very real way. She talks about her faith openly. It's a very real faith, her belief in Christ, her belief in how this faith tradition has shaped her in her home church is vital.
Now, how would you think that has flowed into this show? That's not a completely normal thing in today's popular culture to have a kind of a respectful character. I mean,
here's what I think was brilliant about how faith kind of came in the second season was that you had in this episode where they really kind of lifted this up. There have been touchstones talking about meaning making all the way throughout, and the kids want to talk about identity formation. And what Ryan Murphy, the showrunner, did, which I think is absolutely brilliant, is he said, "Let's think about all the strange things nobody's going to expect." Well, nobody's going to expect a church episode, and so what he did is he did the very thing that contemporary mainstream churches don't realize, is that it's actually quite evocative to talk about faith, and it's downright weird to talk about faith openly. You know, and so you have a show like this doing it in a way that's so openly and so out there that everybody wants to talk about it. It blew up on the blogosphere when the episode came out. I mean,
let's talk about the episode since you've prompted it.
All right, set up grilled cheeses.
But I know you want to set up grilled cheeses, but I also just want to say too that you were talking about Mercedes being, you know, the faith core, but you also have the first season Quinn Fabre, who's the president of the Celibacy Club, wearing her silver cross, who gets pregnant. Who, you know, sort of becomes this stereotypical...
Who's thrown out of the house by her parents.
Her Christian parents.
Her devout, who won't have anything to do with her. So one of the things you do, which again is part of the show, I think is really helpful, is it problematizes categories, right? What does it mean to be a Christian? Well, let's give you some examples of different ways that people talk about it. And where are you going to go with this? And what's really interesting, the most devout and supposedly the most dogmatic becomes the most ungraceful, heartless... But the person who becomes the most gratuitous, who draws people into community, actually becomes speaking about the gospel in a way that people can hear, and they become friends.
Two characters are Mercedes.
Please bring us to grilled cheeses.
Grilled cheeses starts with.
This is season two.
And Finn is making himself a grilled cheese sandwich on George Foreman, and he opens up the grill, and there's Jesus's face
on the sandwich,
the grilled cheese sandwich. And he cuts it.
It could happen.
And he's he says something to the fact of, it was Jesus, but I was hungry. So he cuts.
He cuts him in half.
He cuts it on a diagonal. So he saved Jesus'
Which is
face.
The best way to eat a sandwich, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. So he eats the bottom half and keeps, and he starts praying to grilled Jesus, about really sort of silly things. Like, I want to win the football game. I want to touch Rachel's boobs. I want to, you know, these sorts of things. I want to be quarterback again. These are the things he's praying to the grilled cheese sandwich about.
And these start coming true.
Yes, and he
so that's
he,
important.
Yeah.
That's important.
He
to know,
wins so. The football game. So he comes to Glee and says, you know, I've met a man and his name is Jesus Christ. And so everything sort of blows up at the beginning of the episode, and there's a dialogue between all the kids where their sort of faith point of view comes out, and Mercedes and Quinn are saying, you know, yeah, I think it'd be great if we sang some gospel songs in here or praise songs. And then Kurt basically says, I think God is Santa Claus for adults, and God's kind of a jerk, isn't he? He makes me gay, and then he has his followers telling me it's something I choose, as if I would choose to be mocked every single day. And during this episode, Kurt's father has a heart attack and is in the hospital. And they don't know if he's going to live. And the other people, Mercedes and Quinn and some of these people, want to pray for him. And even Rachel, who's Jewish, is praying for him.
Rachel and Puck are the two Jewish characters.
The two Jewish characters, and they want to pray for his dad, and he doesn't want anything to do with it. And so this whole episode is basically watching, you know, it's kind of Kurt's episode, but you watch him go through a little bit of an arc with this, and you see all these other characters kind of come out of the closet in their own way with their faith on what they believe.
So you said that the blogosphere came alive with this. Was it considered disrespectful of religion? I mean, grilled cheeses, cutting Jesus in half. because I'm hungry. Was it considered a serious exploration? Was it? How did it go down with people?
Well, this is the part that I think is really interesting, is that when Glee started as a show, I was blogging about the show and thinking, this is a great show. People should watch this. And I had friends who were in the church saying, how could you watch a show like that? You know, this is a horrible show. I mean, you have teenagers being promiscuous. You have a young teenage girl who's pregnant on the show. I mean, why would you even be part of that show? And then all of a sudden, boom, God showed up in the show, and then people were like, I don't know what to do with this because I was told I shouldn't watch this show, but it's talking about God that in ways that not anything on the 700 Club was talking about in a very interesting way. Not the 700 Club is not, but it was talking about it in a problematized way.
I thought you could buy a grilled Cheez-Its on 700 Club for a donation of $500.
Right, right. I'm not going down your off ramp. Now there.
I'm off the road, buddy.
You're four-wheeling, and I'm not going there. But there are multiple ways that we talk about faith in our American culture. And one of the things that people didn't expect was a show that many, particularly from evangelicals, thought would have nothing to do with it, surprise them.
Yeah.
And that surprise factor then is what lit it up. And so a number of colleagues of mine who teach in theology and culture all of a sudden jumped all over the place thinking, okay, now what do we do with this show? Yeah. How do we read this backwards into the show?
Can I just add what was an interesting point, too, is that it became this sort of free speech issue because Will was wanting to encourage the students to sing spiritual songs. And then Sue Sylvester comes in and says, separation church and state. Kurt reports them to the school board. Will almost loses his job because they're going to sing these spiritual songs in choir. So it turns it on its head.
Interesting. So when we look at the treatment of all these issues on Glee, it's Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday. He said, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And when you look at how this show deals with differences, gender, religion, jocks, singers, would you say Glee is, and it's definitely celebrating the acceptance of diversity, is it a fulfillment of King's dream, or is it a superficial gloss of kind of politically correct dribble? In other words, is this actually saying anything serious, or is it a kind of an easy, let's make a lot of money off this show, and let's do it by exploiting the kind of hot buttons that people have in our culture today?
I think, again, to kind of keep it in the Glee universe, I think it's both. You can't have it one way or the other. They won't allow you to say it's either has to be this or that. It is both an incredibly profitable money machine that intentionally chooses, using kind of schematics of what pop songs were popular 20 years ago, bringing them back and bridging them into them, creating new ways of selling songs. You can be that hardcore about it. But there is a narrative arc that is deeply meaningful. And it's quite frankly, I mean, and pop culture does this, even though people don't like to admit it, it's actually changing lives. There are kids who are watching this show who are encouraged because of their sense of complexity of their identity, identifying with complex characters, and now talking about it.
So
there was a whole movement within after the Grilled Cheeses episode where you had Glee clubs in schools using that episode to argue for gospel tunes being sung in competitions.
Wow.
Right? And so you have something like that that's affecting the way kids think about themselves and thinking, maybe I can talk. And that's, in many ways, more potent than a year of many youth groups in whether
you're yeah.
Right?
So now, you saw the value of the show before the Grilled Cheeses episode. And no, you were telling people you should be watching this. What was it that you were seeing that you were connecting to and saying, this is important?
Well, from the beginning, this on a couple of different fronts. Beginning, one of the things is, as a theologian who studies teenagers and thinks about teenagers a lot and how teenagers understand faith, I mean, that's one of the things I do. Any show that's going to deal with teenagers, I'm going to jump on it. I want to see what they're doing, how they're thinking about it. And the fact that when they create, we're talking about the pilot, from the very beginning, the show created a moment of kind of this, that teenagers need family They need role models, and they need each other. Those three things are constitutive of how teenagers make meaning and survive into adulthood. And by survive, I mean it quite seriously. The recent census that many of you have participated in, just as an example, right? Okay, there are 22 million teenagers between the ages of 14 to 18 in America today, right? I mean, that's what the census is telling us. Now, of those teenagers in America, one-third, 28% of those teenagers have no father at home. So one in three don't have a parent figure. So they have to create a sense of family, they have to create a new sense of identity around this kind of picture, and so they need other role models. So this is a show that says role models are important, like a Mr. Shu, like a Sue Sylvester, you know, these kind of things are important. But also you have to create your own family at school because your parents are gone. One of the things that's interesting about the show, we were talking about this, Kurt's father and Finn's mother are really the only parents in the show. We don't see, for two seasons, we have yet to see the other parents really show up in the show because this is the story of many American teenagers. Their parents aren't part of their lives. They're sent to school, they come home, they go to bed, they make their own dinner, and they get up the next day. And because of that, they have to raise themselves and create a morality within themselves. So I'm fascinated by the show because it actually is a pretty true picture of American teenage development with good music.
And you know, so excellent.
And you can dance to it.
Dick, yeah. I would just say, at the risk of seeming incredibly sappy and not cynical at all, which is pretty much my MO, I mean...
Way to be radical.
I have to say, I watch my middle school and high school kids and older elementary school kids watch the show, and they see underdogs surviving. They see kids getting bullied and then other kids standing up for them. They see kids sort of letting their freak flag fly or being weird, and it's okay. And you know, everyone's sort of finding a place. I mean, last night when, you know, Chris Colfer won his Golden Globe, he was like, into all those people that say you can't do it or you have to fit into a mold or, you know, you're never going to be successful. You know, to all of them, I say, you know, screw that or suck it or something. I can't remember his exact quote, but he was like, because look, I have a Golden Globe. I mean, it was this really...
And I'm a warbler.
I mean, yeah, but it was just...
So now... I want to ask a question about the tone, since you've come out of the closet as not cynical at all and sappy.
I'm really not.
Would you say that the tone of the show about this music is kind of an elevation of sincerity in kids? Mm. Like when they're singing these ballads, that they really seem to be feeling and wanting to connect with something that's kind of purer than the rest of life?
Well, I think that's why the ballads and the emotional moments actually, when they work really well, that's why they work well. I mean, because there's an emotional understory to something that they're singing. We were talking about grilled cheeses and Rachel, when they're all praying in the hospital bed over over Kurt's dad, she sings "Papa, Can You Hear Me?" from Yentl, and they're praying, and Kurt's watching, and even though Kurt thinks, you know, no one, you know, but there's something completely sincere about that moment.
Yeah. There was this book about nihilism from Kafka, from Nietzsche to Seinfeld a few years ago, talking about basically that this is a nihilistic generation. This is a whatever generation. This is an indifferent generation. And what you see in this show is people that are passionate about something even seem to be sincere about it.
Yeah,
I mean, they want love to be real. They want to believe in something bigger and transcendent.
Yeah. But isn't that what all teenagers want? They want to believe that these love stories are real. They want to believe that they mean something
in the
world.
But they don't know how to say it, right? So again, not to be a data geek, but I'm going to do some more data. So the National Study for Youth and Religion in 2005, largest longitudinal study of teenagers and how they believe and what they believe, right? Across religious traditions, right? One of the findings out of that study was that the closer that we get to something that really matters, the harder we have the harder it is for us to know what to say, right? So things that are closest to our heart, we can't articulate it. But things that we care less about, we have an easier time articulating. And certainly this is true with teenagers. So inarticulacy actually gets us closer and closer to what we actually care about, right? So in families, for example, family systems where you have families where they don't ever say, I love you, if you can just say it, there's something about that. Even though the language in and of itself never captures all that it means, it does still mean something. So where do teenagers go if they have no ability to say it? They make you, they burn you a CD, or they make you, or my generation, we made a mixtape, and say, I don't know what I feel about you, but here, will you go with me to the prom, and I give you this cassette tape, and you take it, and you play it in your car, and you go, yes, and I'm John Cusack holding this big boombox over my head, right? And I'm saying, yes, will you please come out of your house, because I don't know how to say it, right?
Right, and so, it's what happens in musicals all the time, right?
Right, right. Yes. Right. So, yeah, because the musicals are walking along, so, oh, I think I'll start singing now, right? And what this is what is captured in that show is the inarticulacy of what matters is actually what's going on. And so each of the songs, and it's really anthems and ballads, right? So you have anthems, which are grand statements of vision that are bigger than myself that everybody can join in on, right? Don't Stop Believing. When we played this at the break, everybody started going for it and mouthing it, you know. Or the ballad, intimacy, closeness, love. I mean, these things that are hard to define become central to that. So, and I think that's what it's touching on in the show and what connects with people.
Well, so would you say that this was as funny? We're talking about the sincerity of the show, the importance of the show, the data of the show, and the crass commercialism of the show. Mm-hmm. That is a total moneymaker. I mean, way, way back when television first started, a guy wrote a book and said, wait a minute, don't you people understand the only reason the show exists is to get you to stay for the ad?
Right.
And now it's to stay for the ad and to download in real time product placement in the show.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you sort that out?
I buy the music. I don't know. I'm an indiscriminate consumer.
The lemming.
Yeah. No, there is reality of the consumerism part of that, right? And certainly with teens, when you talk about kind of their relationship to the show, some of that is because it is a very popular show. Teenagers want to be around that which is popular because it gives them surrogate meaning for a time. It gives them a way to identify with something larger than myself for a time. And that's what fashion does. That's what consumerism does.
Now, you actually were going to talk about an episode called The Substitute.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
We have kind of a big star showing up on this show.
Yeah,
why?
Mrs. Chris Martin, otherwise known as Gwyneth Paltrow, Academy Award-winning actress from Shakespeare in Love and been a lot of things, was it one of the guest stars on the show. Holly Holiday was her character. She played a substitute teacher at the school who really secretly always wanted to be the glee teacher. And what happens in the show is that Mr. Shoe, gets really sick and has to go home and they need a substitute. She moves in. She turns out to be the coolest substitute you've ever had in your life. One of my favorite lines in all of Gleedom that is uttered is when she's up there talking about a song by CeeLo, who's a really hot artist right now, and she's mentioning this particular song, and one of the characters, Santana, who we haven't talked about yet, says to her, "What do you know about CeeLo? You're like 40 or something." And Holly Holiday replies, "That's top 40, sweet cheeks." And then jumps right into singing the song in full dance number, and everybody joins in as the song goes forward. What I was going to mention with The Substitute and with other guest stars is now the show has become kind of the tastemaker show for people to go on. It's kind of like what The Simpsons was. If you were made into a Simpsons animated character, that was your stardom moment, right? And now guest starring on Glee is one of those moments. And so you have Neil Patrick Harris having done a turn on that. You have, who was the actress from Wicked who was on there?
Kristen Chenoweth.
Also Idina Menzel, who was in Wicked as well.
Right. So we have very famous Broadway actress.
Jonathan
Groff from Spring Awakening was on there. And so one of the things about the show is it's been bringing in substitute teachers, but the thing, and also guest stars. And these guest stars have continually always been kind of surrogate parents as well in the show. They've been kind of moral touchstones as they show up. They kind of work out their stuff in front of the kids. And what's really shown in the show in the use of guest stars is the reality of step-parents. Is that you have people who come in and out of teens' lives all the time. They offer something, but then they never come back again. And it's one of the things that's really interesting in the show is the show hasn't really kept some of these people around. They come in for a time and they disappear. And that's a kind of a thing we can talk about as we come back from the break.
Well, we're going to, next we're going to go to the audience, find out what kind of questions we've got out there, and we'll hear more from our panel as well. You're listening to Kindling's Music, Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. We're talking about Glee. Turns out it's a deeply intellectual, socially provocative, life-changing show. And we'll learn more about that coming up right after this.
This is Dick Stomp back with you. We're listening to the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub talking about Glee tonight, and we've got an occasional Gleek in the audience and all sorts of interesting conversation. I was telling Jeff it's a subject that on the one hand seems like it's pretty kind of superficial. It's pop culture. But on the other hand, there's a certain level of depth about the subject, and I like the way we've gotten that balance going here tonight. We're going to get started with some of your questions tonight. Just give me your first name and your question.
My name is Chester. The question is the writing and trajectory of the show enough to carry it through the show's characters' graduation as well as the audience's? And this is a two-part question. And the second part is this just a grandiose idealism of pop culture?
Whoa. Next question.
Jenny's going to take the first part.
I'm going to take the first part. We were actually just talking about this in the green room. Are they ever going to graduate? I said maybe they'll be Glee, you know, college years, like Saved by the Bell or something. But no. If they're smart, they won't let this jump the shark, and they'll just have the kids graduate, and that'll just be the end of the show. And they'll have, you know, they'll go cry in their big bags of money, and, you know, that'll be the end of Glee.
They'll launch their careers.
Exactly.
What about the idealism of pop culture?
Well, you're asking probably the wrong person, because I think pop culture is awesome. So I just don't think that, you know, there's a problem there. I mean, you set the question. I mean, you set the question about pop culture as if it's a bad thing, and I actually think it's a great thing. So as far as an idea,
I think he wants to rebut. Okay, your assumption.
Okay, oh, that's fine.
No,
okay,
I definitely agree with you. I love pop culture. I totally dig it, and I think like this sort of like this generation's like what they have to say is pop. Like what they have to say, they do through pop culture. Like, a lot of things are very here and now, and I think that's evident in, like,
I think every
coming of age, right? And I think that's said more so through this generation in pop culture, with, like, huge pop trends that are just, like, that's how kids function nowadays, as opposed to, like, taking up arms against wars and marches and stuff.
So. Okay, well, so on that point,
Glee
yeah.
or war?
Yeah, right. Well, okay, that's
what sounds good to you, Mom.
Well, see, that qualification I think is a really interesting one. Is that, you know, is a show like this, you know, people watching Glee, is that distracting them from the things that are really important? You know, put that in scare quotes. You know, huge economic upheavals. You know, questions about our political direction. You know, wars and rumors of wars. You know, diseases that need to be cured. You know, why are we watching a show about an Ohio Glee Club? And I think, you know, at some point there are questions that fuel how we change the world and how we engage the bigger questions, right? And so at some point you're going to have to ask the question of what animates who you are and where that comes from. And so part of that's going to ground itself in the coming of age moment. You know, why did you become an adult? How did you become an adult? So both for teenagers, they're trying to figure out, how do I do that? What's the roadmap for it? But also for the adults that are watching the show, that are reflecting back on their own teenage experience, going through their midlife crises or their own malaise or despair about, how did I become this? And now I this is the Mr. Schuster character, right? You know, how do I return back to the things that are most valuable to me? And in that way, a show like Glee is actually quite vital. You know, and again, you quote me on this, but I think Glee can actually help us solve our economic crisis, not because it's selling so many songs, but because it's asking first the question of, if you start with community first, if you start with deep friendship first, if you start with meaning-making first, then the other things will happen. If you try to figure out security, if you try to get as much money as possible, if you try to figure out how to do things through legislation and then think that'll get you to community, you'll lose. So it's forcing you to think about family, intimacy, questions of meaning-making. Do that first, get that right, and if you can really do it with authenticity, maybe the rest of the world will change.
Okay, next question. Ben.
Do teenagers have a unique capacity to create art / tell stories in ways that are more successful than adult professionals? In other words, could going to the neighborhood high school musical be the best ticket in town?
Well, that's just a big, gigantic yes from me.
No cynicism, heart on her sleeve. Heather Hawkins weighs in on this deep question.
So I'll go back to Chris Colfer, who, you know, again, who plays Kurt Hummel, who was acting in his high school musicals in his small town in California when he got this job. And here he is as a teenager telling this story. And I think that while not everyone on the show that's playing a teenager is a teenager, I think they range from like 18 to 28.
28, yeah.
I do think that those actors on the show possess a different viewpoint of life, their different point in their lives, a different way of telling us a story than much older actors. And then taking it on that really personal sort of local level, I can pay, I do pay hundreds of dollars to see shows in New York or shows at Fifth Avenue with adult professional actors, but sometimes I will see young people and teenagers tell a story in a way without all the glitz and without all the set pieces that touches my soul in a completely different way than those polished adult actors. I don't know if it's a sense of rawness. It's a sense of immediacy. I directed a production of Jason Robert Brown's musical 13 last spring at Eckstein Middle School. And so here are 13-year-olds singing about being 13. And there's just nothing like it. I mean, you're listening to them tell you a story from their point of view and their immediacy that's really powerful. And
But in that sense, Glee perpetuates a problem because it's all prose. It's totally produced. It's very, very slick.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have that kind of raw kind of teenagerism.
Although I don't know, I might disagree with you a little bit. I mean, I think some of those kids...
But I'm the host.
I know.
I must be right.
But
the host must be broken and given away.
Oh! Thank you, Jeff.
Wow.
A new commandment I give you, that we love one another. You were going to disagree with me.
Well, yes. Yes, a lot of them have been seasoned professionals. But some of them were plucked from obscurity and hadn't ever, done huge things before. Okay.
Can I just add really quickly, yes. Dick, if you live in the Seattle area and have not been to a production of Roosevelt High School, you are missing out. So go to especially their spring musical. It's pretty spectacular.
Who says we don't have product placement? Rick, your question or comment.
And I will preface my question by saying I don't own a TV, so I don't watch a lot of TV. And
so you're not an American.
And I live and work in the inner city. So my question is, how do you think the show relates to inner city kids and inner city life? I don't hear these kids singing these songs or talking about the show. You mentioned three things, family, mentoring, and there was one other thing.
And the nature of making community.
Yeah, and I feel that chasm a lot just where I live and work.
Yeah, so. Yeah, great point. And one of the things actually that a show like Glee can certainly be pushed on is that it's basically another way of kind of perpetuating suburban culture, right? You know, which is the commodification of identity as opposed to real identity. A couple of things on that. I do think the show has not done a great job as far as going into the city. I mean, you hear talk of the characters. The character Puck, for example, is in and out of juvie all the time, and he is kind of the school thug in many ways, and who's in the midst of this this group, and also Mercedes. I mean, when her church is a city church, it's not out in the suburbs in that way. So you're right. I mean, the show has not touched on kind of urbanization as far as that goes, but what it has done, quite frankly, is it's really kind of pushed on the idea of the commodification of America anyway. So again, having worked with inner city kids, having done work within the city. Youth culture is more in touch with itself than it is about its own sense of place. If you go to inner city London, inner city LA, inner city New York, inner city Seattle, those places are going to have more in common with each other than the very countries they come from, because of the nature of the transference and the globalization of youth culture. And part of that is music, right? And so one of the things you see in the show is they're taking CeeLo. They're doing Kanye. Yeah, they're doing Jay-Z. They're doing kind of the typical hip-hop, grand stars. They're also taking a number of other artists, and they're mashing them together. And that's actually what's happening in DJ culture and hip-hop culture as well, is they're taking some of the best and the brightest across the generations, and they're doing that. And that's something actually that's quite celebrated in urban youth culture. So you're right as far as they're not actually taking the show on location to the projects, but they are kind of talking about it in a way that they do their show.
Christy, your question.
Yeah, I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about the sexuality on the show. normalizing sexual experimentation, bisexuality, promiscuity, especially of Santana, Britney. It's very casual. It comes up a lot. And I'm a huge fan of the show. But just in passing, they make a lot of comments about just sexual acts that they perform and things like that that I did not hear when I was in high school. Yeah. So,
well, yeah. That is a part of the teen culture right now, and sexuality, and all sorts of things that we have never heard of. Even the younger adults among us are going on in teen culture right now. But also, there was a great, and I cannot remember the episode title, but a discussion of losing your virginity, and Rachel, as main character, wants to keep her virginity until she is married, and Finn was a virgin but didn't want anybody to know about it. And there was actually a fairly emotionally compelling episode about that very topic, and what wound up happening in the episode. And I think they dealt with it in a fairly mature way and didn't sort of put it down as something like, oh, this is what everybody does. I mean, here's the captain of the football team and he's not had sex. And what does that mean?
I think actually one of the pairings that's been really interesting in the show has been Artie and Brittany, because Artie is the boy in the wheelchair and he's paralyzed from the waist down and doesn't think that he can be sexually active. It wasn't sure. It only found out recently, as he said, that he could have sex. And Brittany, who is kind of, she usually gets all the one lines. It's kind of his brainless airhead character.
She thinks adultery is acting like an adult.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. She actually says that on the show. And so but she doesn't, there's a level of innocence to that. But she has sex with Artie, and Artie loses his virginity to Brittany. And they kind of become a couple for a while, and they drift apart, and he doesn't know why. And there's a very interesting, quite touching, and quite moving situation where he is really struggling with what's just happened. I mean, that they've had sex. He didn't know he could have sex. Now they did. What does this mean? And then, in addition to the sexual identity questions, I mean, with the Kirk character being very out as gay, with a number of other things, the show forces, I think, households to have to talk about sex. And actually, this is something a lot of church families just don't do. They don't sit down with their kids and say, what do you think about this? And if it's wrong to have premarital sex, they want to know why. And it's not enough to say, well, just don't do it. It's to talk about the ramifications. And actually, the show gives you some license to talk about it, because you see the characters looking at the wages of it. You have the Quinn Fabre character who becomes pregnant, the grieving that she goes through that. You have this Artie character who regrets it but not knows what to do with it. And this, a show like that actually gives Christian parents something to talk about.
Okay. Christine, your question.
Hi. I wanted to know, what do you guys think about this? How does Sue Sylvester fit into the Glee universe other than just being Will's nemesis? Where is there, if any, hope or joy in her character?
Well, I hope or joy is an interesting question. One of the things that about Sue Sylvester is she has a sister who is a Down syndrome. And she's in her entire life dealt with the question of how people have treated her sister. So over and over and over in the character arcs of the show, she'll keep coming back to the fact that part of who has formed her, other than having Carol Burnett, who was her mother on the show, which
the
is
Nazi
on
there, hunter,
who's a Nazi hunter on the show, which is perfect for Carol Burnett. But the fact, the way that people treated her sister has really framed how she sees God. So in the Grilled Cheeses episode, that's why she. Because she prayed, for this healing for their sister, and it didn't happen, so she deals with that. But so I actually think, quite frankly, Sue Sylvester is probably the most faithful character in many ways, because she really honestly struggles with these questions, and her brashness and her bravado is a way for her to not have to talk about it. But us as the audience, who get to see the other side of Sue, get to see these moments that keep happening. Like in the Christmas episode, she plays the Grinch, with the overture of her slithering around as the Grinch, taking all the ornaments from the tree, but then giving all the presents back at the end. I mean, she becomes this kind of, not just a morality tale, but she has some of that as well too.
You do know there's a soft side to her. I mean, just as the audience, that that's there. I mean, even in the last the season finale, she's one of the judges for, was it regionals or something?
Yeah, sectionals for regionals
or whatever.
With Olivia Newton-John.
Right, and, right. and she votes for their Glee team, their Glee club. And the whole year, she's been like, get rid of this Glee club, get rid of this Glee club. And she ultimately sort of stands up for them at that point.
And in terms of dramatic structure, I think that's also exciting for me, is that when you have someone who's that brash and that cynical and, you know, who has the best one-liners ever in the show, that when you see her turn to be hopeful or to find these moments of joy with her sister, that is so interesting, I think, for me as an audience member.
Yeah, the moments on the show when she and her sister are together mm-hmm. are some of the most heartbreaking moments of two siblings just being together, and how much she actually loves her sister. And basically this persona she's created around herself is to protect her sister, who she views as so harmed from the world. But the actress who plays her sister keeps telling Sue about how much to love. And you can see her break down all this time. And so it's actually a really wonderful interchange.
Skye, what's your question?
Well, along the lines of both and, we live in a world of either or, red or blue. And so consequently, I guess my question is, how can popular and relevant coexist?
I just think they do. I guess. I think they do. I think that there is relevancy amidst things that are popular. I think sometimes we dismiss the things that are grossly popular as being irrelevant because they are. I mean, some of my students, for example, will kind of lynch onto a particular indie band and they think they're really great, but when they blow up as becoming popular, then they want to distance themselves from it, right? Because there's something about the idea of identifying with somebody or something that's also marginalized or an outlier gives me some kind of identity. And I think that popular doesn't necessarily have to mean wrong. Or something like that. And so, and I think, you know, in the show, you know, who knows if the show will make it to a third season. You know, it's had a good run and it's been a very popular show. It's also very relevant in what it's doing. And it could, you know,
But, you know, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I mean, Shakespeare was an example of somebody that was very popular and had a lot to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In his time, he figured out how to be entertaining to the masses, to everyday people, and still raise the issues mm-hmm. that were important to them. Well, and that's... That's kind of the genius of something that does that, is that ability to bring both together.
Well, and you know, as Jeff's saying, just because it's popular, it has to be irrelevant. I think it's the opposite. Because it's popular, there's something relevant there, or it wouldn't be catching all over. Millions of people wouldn't like it or find something about it that is entertaining if there wasn't something relevant at its core. So that's our job, especially in shows to find that relevance.
Yeah, I find that interesting in relationship with what Jeff was saying about inarticulate, because the degree to which we find our articulation through consuming what others create and then presenting it as our own is a certain level of confessional about our own inability to develop into who we should become. You know, a truly authentic person doesn't need others to give articulation to everything that they think. There's nothing wrong with being referential, but being able to say what you think as your own thought and not simply relying on other people to say it is part of what has always been considered, you know, being a more complete human being. And I'm interested in that in relationship with what Chester said earlier, because this is a generation that's articulating their views through popular culture. So there's a really interesting dynamic here between the surrogate communicator on behalf of a generation and the rest of the generation that is allowing themselves to basically use popular culture to be their medium of communication. What's your comment, Todd?
Well, I'll preface this by saying I've actually never seen an episode of Glee, so this may be an error.
He's lying, he's lying, he's lying. Yeah. No, I'm sorry, go ahead, Todd.
But what I've heard about the adults, like Christian Chenoweth's character was alcoholic, mm-hmm. and you haven't painted any other adults with a very positive light. I'm wondering if the producers of the show are trying to create a don't trust anybody over 30 mentality again, or if they're just trying to say, kids, your problems aren't going to change when you get to adulthood. They're just going to be different.
Yeah, I would think it is more towards that. But Mr. Shu, I think, is he really is kind of a hero for these students. And he's in his mid-30s and going through these struggles. But yeah, the other guest stars and some of these other adults that you see, they do some sort of reprehensible things. But there is that element of, you know, hey, kids, you got to work this out now, because if you don't work it out now, you know, you can be Christian Chenoweth squatting in a million-dollar house and, you know, drinking herself.
But he's also alone. I mean, he hasn't been able to pull together a deep, intimate, personal relationship in a marriage, and that continues to be frustrated in the show. So in that sense, the adult that is viewed as the kind of parent is one who is not part of a you know, marriage relationship of fidelity and, you know, something that traditionally might have been thought of as an important stabilizing force in the kid's life.
Right. But going back to the pilot, which we started the show talking about, is that there's a moment where the guidance counselor, I can't remember the character's name who plays the guidance counselor, who Mr. Shue has this.
Emma.
Yep. One of the big turning points in that show is that Emma brings up a YouTube video or something of them winning regionals back when he was in there. And she challenges them to say, these kids need you, and you need them. Right? And so getting back to that question about adults, one of the things I think the show does do quite well is it really outs all of us who consider ourselves adults as saying, you have not got it together and you know it. You go to bed and you put your head on your pillow at night, and when nobody's looking and you're just about that moment to being sleepy, you know that you're really messed up. And you know you haven't fulfilled everything you hoped for.
Jeff,
right?
My two of my children are here too.
Right. But if you can sit in the knowledge of the fact that what it means to become an adult is always a becoming, then maybe you actually have a lot more in common with teenagers than you give yourself credit for. And that doesn't mean becoming like a teenager as far as inarticulacy or whatever, but you have the vantage point of having experienced things and also have an ability to love and a capacity to love to draw them in. And because what makes parents is their children. Right? And so when he brings that in, it becomes a community. Like in the Christmas show, one of the things that is quite beautiful in the show, quite frankly, is that Mr. Shue goes back to this supposedly empty apartment. You know, he feels, you know, this sense of, I have nothing in my life. And the kids are in this apartment. They're decorating a tree for him, and they create this thing called family. And in the New Testament, you know, the term oikos or household is all over the place in ways that family isn't. Because it's not about the nuclear family. It's about what kind of families are created when we join faith together. And you can make meaning. This is what the 90s show Friends was trying to do. This is what Glee is also doing, is that we have to find that sense of community. And if we find it around things that are bigger than ourselves, it can last. If it's shallow, then it won't. And I think that's what you get in with the adults. The adults have got to find meaning in giving their life to these kids. If it's all about self-fulfillment for themselves, how fast can I retire? How fast can I go on vacation? How fast can I be done with my thing and then finish out? Then that's a waste. I mean, the first baby boomers are turning 65 this year. You know, they were born in 1946. And this is the generation that's got to figure out what they're going to do with the so-called retirement age. Are they going to give it back to the next generation, or are they just going to go golfing? And that's the question that I think Glee is asking, too, with adults.
Hmm. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. We're going to end with a final comment from each of our panelists tonight. And thank you for your interesting comments. And we'll start with Heather.
You know, sometimes people criticize Glee for various reasons. I don't know why they would. But for me, you know, sometimes I just want to say, you know, who cares about the plot or the realism or the motivation or whether or not sometimes these characters have the exact right dramatic consequences. For me, sometimes I want to show up every week, you know, for those two or three moments that make me laugh or cry or, you know, want to cheer or want to stand up in my living room and sing and dance at the top of my lungs.
And you've done that.
Oh,
I bet you have.
Oh, I have many times.
Oh, how fun to think
many,
about
many
that.
Many times.
Jenny.
I'm just waiting for Glee to do some ABBA.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I know there was Mamma Mia, but let's get a little bit deeper into the ABBA tracks.
Into the catalog.
Into the ABBA catalog. That's what I'm waiting for. Come on, producers. Let's go. Take a chance on me.
Okay, Jeff, top that, buddy.
I can't. I can't. I'm going to come back to the grilled cheeses episode. And again, I mean, there are a number of different episodes I'd really encourage you to see. If you've never seen Glee, you know, see the pilot. You know, it's a really great pilot way to launch a show. I think the grilled cheeses episode we talked about is really worth watching. It's a really intriguing episode. The Substitute is another one that's interesting if you're interested in those. But I want to take a quote away as a kind of a for me on the Grilled Cheeses episode is that we talked about Mercedes, this character, this African-American young woman who is the diva voice, you know, in the show. And she befriends this the Kurt, who we've mentioned before. And Kurt just can't believe in God. He cannot believe in God in this show. And the show really ends with her and this great quote. And they're at the front of the lockers where all monumental decisions are made in our teenage years, right? In front of our lockers. And they're standing there. And she says to Kurt, "I know you don't believe in God. And that's okay, each to his own. But you have to believe in something." She stops there. And with that moment, she just says, "You know, we're friends before we believe. So will, as my friend, will you come to my church?" And she brings Kurt to church. And Kurt sits in the pew as a non-believer, gets loved on in this African-American church. And I just love that quote, and I think it's a great one for you to take away to your friends, to your family, you know, to people you're kind of talking about, even praying for, is to say, you know what, you don't believe in God, that's okay, but you know, you got to believe in something, you know, and, you know, to kind of leave it with Journey, you know, don't stop believing, you know, you got to believe in something, and where are you going to put that need? You know, where are you going to front it? And I think Mercedes gives us a clue and a way to talk about it with our kids, with our families, and with our friends on that.
Well, I'm going to end as well with a comment that I've been thinking about throughout the show tonight. That is, the former religion editor of Publisher Weekly said, "More theology is conveyed in and probably retained from 1 hour of popular television than from all the sermons that are also delivered on any given weekend in America's synagogues, churches, and mosques." Here we've got this show that seems to just be a pop culture phenomenon and questions about relevance and connectivity, and yet we've seen tonight, not just in the Grilled Cheeses episode, but throughout, there's a lot of stuff going on in this show. There's a lot of theology in this show. It's teaching, it's educating, it's provoking, and it's an interesting conversation to be part of. I want to thank each of our panelists. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for being with us tonight on the Kindlings Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub.